Welcome to, I guess, the first official day of core courses. I'm very excited to be here. It's been a long time that I've been waiting. So this is the opening slide for this lecture, and it's actually the most impressive slide that I have. It's all downhill from here. But this course, it's going to be a course on quantum theory, and it will be taught in two sections. The first half will be taught by me. The second half will be taught by Maita. And throughout the whole program, we're also going to have Tomasz Gonda, who will be the TA for the course. He's really great, and he's going to be able to give us a third perspective on things. And so we're very lucky to have him in the tutorials. Okay, so the main point of this course is to prepare you for all of the upcoming courses, for example, quantum field theory, condensed matter, relativistic quantum information, quantum foundations, normal quantum information. And it's also to give you the tools and the formalism, different formalisms that you might need for a lot of the research that you'll be involved in throughout this program and also in the rest of your research career. So we'll mostly focus on the various formalisms that people use to deal with quantum theory. And in the first part of the course, I'm going to focus on these generalized axioms. So they're a way of talking about quantum theory in a more abstract way. And in doing so, we'll also have to discuss quantum entanglement to some degree. And we're going to do this in what's known as the operational framework. So it's kind of a different way of thinking about quantum mechanics or quantum theory from a conceptual perspective. And this is going to have applications in quantum information and quantum optics. So if you're going to do research in that, it's going to be really useful for you. The operational framework is going to be really useful for foundations of quantum mechanics. So a lot of people in that field think operationally, or at least are very comfortable thinking operationally. And the entanglement side is going to have applications for areas of physics such as black hole physics and ADS-CFT. Then when Maita comes in, she's going to discuss canonical quantization and the path integral formalism, which will have applications in perturbation theory and Feynman diagrams. So she's going to talk about that. She'll also discuss second quantization and show how that's got applications to many body physics. And so the parts of her course are going to mainly be useful for the quantum field theory courses and the quantum gravity courses. And condensed matter will also kind of use bits of my part of the course and Maita's part of the course. Okay, so assessment, fun stuff. So the assessment here is going to consist of three homeworks. The first homework is going to be a continuous assessment. So we're going to have quizzes all throughout the course every couple of days. Then the second and third homeworks are going to be problem sets. So the second homework we will give out on Monday the 9th. So that's the next week. And it'll be due 1 week later. The third homework will be given out the following Monday and due 1 week later. And all of this information, I see some of you are writing down, all of this is in the course outline that's on the wiki as well. And we're also going to have interviews, which are going to be in the week. So after the course finishes, you will have a week break, and then the interviews will start after that. They typically last for 4 days, but we haven't picked which 4 days yet, so there's a range of 5 days at the moment. They're roughly 30 to 40 minutes each. And they're going to be conducted by me and Maita. And you'll get an exam, a set of questions that we'll choose from throughout the interviews. And also in the last tutorial, we're going to have an opportunity for you to practice answering some of these interview questions just to get you kind of in the swing of things. Okay, so just a little bit about homework one. It's based on continuous assessment. Like I said, we'll have questions every couple of days. Those questions, it'll be just a short quiz with just testing your recollection or your understanding of material from the previous couple of days. At the end of the quiz, you'll also have an opportunity to just tell me what you thought was really confusing or maybe what you would like clarified. So hopefully I will then be able to address that in the next lecture. And so the advantages of that are that you get to work regularly on these things. You'll get feedback regularly. You'll be able to make connections between different lectures and tutorials. Okay, so a little about tutorials. They're mandatory. So if you want to pass the course, you have to attend the tutorials and you have to participate in them actively. So what I mean by actively is that well, you have to do the problem sets, hopefully discuss them with your peers. If, you know, if it happens that you're just like super familiar with this material and like it's not going to be useful for you to actually go through and do the problem sets, or if maybe you've done them really quickly or something, that doesn't mean that you should just like leave or maybe do other stuff. At that point, you should use the fact that you have superior knowledge to help your peers. So maybe you can help those around you or, you know, discuss some things with them. That's very useful for the people doing the explaining, and it'll be useful for your friends as well. So most of the tutorials are going to be problem sets. But some of the tutorials will start with a group activity. And so these group activities require some planning on our part. So if you have to miss one of the tutorials, like that's okay. Like sometimes you have other things like a group meeting or you have to meet with your supervisor or a seminar, but please tell us in advance. Don't just show up after and say, oh, hey, I missed the tutorial. Please tell us in advance so we can plan accordingly. But we'll always try and make it work for you. Okay, so just to kind of recap, the outline of the course is that it's split up into two parts. The first half will be taught by me, so there we will cover the generalized axioms, operational framework, and entanglement. And then Maita is going to do the second half. She'll do canonical Dirac quantization, path integral quantization, and Feynman diagrams. And just to give you a visual representation of that, what that'll look like, those first blue days are mine, the red ones are Maita, and then the last day will kind of, I think Maita will finish off her course on the last day, and then maybe her and I will give you a bit of a presentation about the research that we're working on, so that you'll be super excited to work with us for your SCI project. And just to show you how the tutorials will work, we'll have only two this week, and then four next week, split between me and Maita, and then she'll do the ones at the end. And then the last tutorial will be just this practice for your interviews. Okay, so, well, any questions on just the admin or the logistical side of the course before I get started on the science? No, okay. So I'm going to do most of these lectures by writing on the board. I have a set of my own kind of colloquial notes that I can make available afterwards. They're very informal, pretty much just like what I'm saying. But I will also give links to more formal discussions of the things that we have in other people's, like other people's lecture notes or textbooks. Okay, so first I want to kind of talk about the structure of quantum theory. So quantum theory can be divided into two distinct parts. Okay, the first part consists of identifying the energy level structure associated with some sort of physical system. So identifying the energy level structure associated with a physical system. So what do I mean by that? I mean, so identifying which Hilbert space is appropriate for describing a particular system. Associated with that will be which Hilbert space vector we might also want to identify what physical forces are affecting the quantum system and how are these modeled by a Hamiltonian. And also, which operator, say A, represents a particular experimental measurement procedure. These don't work, do they? Okay, so that's the first part. Then the second part is a little bit more abstract. And it consists of predicting the statistics associated with an agent's interactions with that system. Okay, so what I mean by that is, given a preparation of some sort of quantum system and a transformation of that quantum system, what is the probability of getting certain measurement outcomes? So both of these parts, they're necessary for describing outcomes of measurements and for modeling particular physical situations. And usually we don't really delineate between these. We kind of just go in and do both things when we're modeling some type of physical situation. But it turns out that the second component is sufficient for just describing the general structure of quantum theory. And so for the most most of the part of my course, we're going to be focusing on just dealing with this abstract component of quantum theory. And we're not really going to worry about how do you get a, how do you decide which Hilbert space corresponds to which physical system? How do we decide which Hamiltonian is the one that we need? And you know, how do we decide what the measurement is? We're going to assume that this is all given, and then we're going to study the consequences of that within this abstract framework. So, any questions about that? Okay, and so this discussion that relates to this abstract part of quantum theory, it's most naturally done in something called the operational framework. So I'm going to describe this operational framework, and then I'll talk a little bit about why it's useful. And since I'm going to be using the word quantum a lot in this course, often I'll just write Q so I don't have to write it out many times. Okay, so in the operational framework, we assume that we can reduce the physical problem into the following sequence of operations. Okay, into preparations, transformations, and measurement. So preparations refer to a procedure that's fixed or repeatable, and this procedure outputs a quantum system. Transformations are dynamical transformations applied to that quantum system. And then measurement is a procedure that produces classical data or classical information as output. So we can describe this kind of in a pictorial way. So let's see. Often when people talk about the operational framework, they describe things in terms, they draw these little boxes that describe each of the procedures. So let me just draw these boxes. So we imagine that a preparation is some device that then spits out some quantum system. The device has a control knob that we can set, so we tune, pick our class, our settings for the preparation. Now I've only drawn one knob because it's this idealized theorist picture, but typically there's going to be different settings on your preparation device. And we're going to have a little button that we press, which is the go button, and it says start the experiment. Then transformations are another box. And this box has an input and an output. And it also has a little setting, a knob, that we can tune to specify the transformation that we're doing. And the final box is a measurement box, which also has an input, and it might have an output as well. It has a setting, a knob that we can tune to pick the measurement, but it also has an additional thing. It has kind of an output that tells us what is the outcome of that measurement. And maybe it has like a little light that says, okay, I've done the measurement. Okay, so each of these operational procedures, they can take as input classical data that specifies at least partially or completely the operation that you're performing. And so in an operational approach, the theory is characterized entirely in terms of predictions for macroscopic experiments described using everyday concepts. So I'm going to write that definition down because it's kind of useful. In an operational approach, the theory is characterized entirely in terms of predictions. For macroscopic experiments, described using everyday concepts. So by everyday concepts, I mean things you would just like see in the lab, like voltages on some oscilloscope, or maybe you have some sort of screen and it like has blips on it, like from a Stern Gerlach experiment. So there's nothing kind of deep going on. It's just regular things that we would see in an experiment. Okay, so what's the what's a different way of thinking than operationally? So an alternative to that would be the realist approach, which is probably the one that you're kind of naturally used to thinking about. You associate a quantum state with the actual physical object. You say, well, I have the quantum state for a electron. So let me just kind of say the formal definition. So in a realist view, you would seek to find deeper explanations for predictions of macroscopic experiments in terms of simple entities and abstract concepts. So in a realist view, you would have some idea of what's actually going on here. Like there's some sort of electron, there's a particle that's traveling through here, and that particle has a wave function. But in an operational approach, we're agnostic to what's happening here. We don't even know if there's anything happening in here. All we're doing is describing things that we're doing in a laboratory. So we prepare things, we do transformations, and then we measure them. Now, it doesn't need to be really an experiment that's done, you know, that each operation is done in the lab. So for example, if you're making cosmological observations or something, you can think about, you know, the sun or some star preparing a state, preparing a state, and then it's some sort of repeatable procedure that the sun spits out some sort of light. So you can still use this framework in a larger setting, but at least conceptually, it's just useful to think that in a lab, we prepare something, transform, and measure. Okay, and so do you absolutely need this operational framework to talk about the math associated with this this abstract formalism? Actually, no, you could just, you know, do the math and have some sort of realist interpretation, but it's just much more natural to think about it this way. You'll find as we go along and start dealing with generalized states and generalized transformations and stuff, it's just much more useful and clear to have this perspective rather than taking a realist view. And it's just good for you to get used to thinking this way. You want to be able to switch between these different perspectives when you're doing physics. So, yeah, are there any questions?
Is there anything intrinsically quantum about this operational framework?
Well, no. So definitely people can use this for classical theories, and they can use it for post-quantum theories as well. And in fact, in foundations, so Rob Speckens will be giving a seminar, I think, next week. So he'll talk about using the operational approach for looking at causal structures and things that may be beyond quantum theory. Yep. Okay, and actually, so Lucien Hardy, who is a faculty member here as well. He works in quantum gravity, and so he's working on formulating a theory of quantum gravity from the operational perspective as well, rather than the typical realist approach that most people take. So yeah, that's a good question. Are there any other questions? Okay. So maybe, yeah, let me talk a little bit more about, so I guess I already sort of mentioned it, but I want to, reiterate why it's useful thinking this way. So you might be thinking, well, this whole thing or maybe not yet because you haven't seen it, but as we go along, you might think, well, this is really abstract. You know, I don't really like it. Or this operational approach is really unnatural. At first, it seems really stupid. Why would you think this way? But the reason you should think, learn to think that way and this way is because this is pretty much the language of modern quantum information theory research. So if you're going to be doing quantum information, you just have to know how to, like, you have to understand how this this approach works, and you have to be really comfortable in it. So within this framework, we all see things like CPTP maps and generalized and weak measurements. And so these are things that are just used a lot in quantum information theory. And yeah, you'll need to know them. It's also just a really like natural and crisp and clean formalism. So actually, maybe let me make a list of these things. The language of modern QI research. Okay, yeah, it's a natural, crisp, and clean formalism. And so I'm talking about this thing here. And so the abstraction really removes a lot of clutter. So one way that's useful is from a practical perspective. If you're trying to design some kind of experiment in a lab, maybe some kind of quantum computing experiment, or you know, some sort of measurement, or spectroscopy, or imaging, or something, it's just really useful to think about it abstractly, design what you want to achieve, and then once you've got that figured out, then you can start thinking about the underlying details about, you know, like what's the actual physics going on underneath. Another way that it's useful is you can think of it as like a good nonsense filter. So, and here I'm kind of talking about the combination of these two things. So sometimes people, when they take a realist view and maybe don't think in this abstract way, they maybe come to some, I know, conclusions about paradoxes that might exist in quantum theory, and things might seem really weird. But then if you just come in and reinterpret everything in terms of this operational framework and in terms of things like CPTP maps and weak measurements and stuff, everything just kind of becomes clear. And yes. Yes, I do, but I'm not going to say it because I'm being recorded. So we can talk in the tutorials. Yeah? So ask me tomorrow. But yeah, there are situations where where people have come in and reworked things and then realized that there's actually nothing really like weird going on. Yeah. Okay. And okay, it's also a lot of the different concepts we're going to discuss, they have connections to other areas of physics. So most of it, it's true, is going to apply for into quantum information and foundations. But if you're not interested in those things, I urge you to still pay attention, because a lot of the quantum information concepts are being ported over to other areas of physics. So things like density operators and entanglement, that's being used in condensed matter. Now different phases of matter are being described in terms of like the entanglement properties of these systems. Like I mentioned in the slides, ADS-CFT also uses these notions of entanglement. The non-unitary dynamics we're going to see in terms of CPTP maps, these are going to be useful in things like the black hole information paradox. There's things that are not understood there in terms of how do we reconcile unitarity of quantum mechanics and the idea that nothing, no information is able to leave the black hole, and as it evaporates, it gets smaller and smaller, eventually disappears. You know, where did that information go? Something non-unitary must have happened, but quantum mechanics tells us that that things should be unitary. So I think understanding this from the perspective that we'll be discussing will be useful. Okay, what have I said? I've said density operators, entanglement, and non-unitary dynamics. These things are already being used in these other areas of physics. We'll also be talking about generalized measurements, which I don't think yet have been ported over to these other areas of physics, but maybe by the time you guys graduate, they will be, and maybe they won't be, and you'll be the ones that will be kind of driving using these techniques there. So some examples that I could imagine are in like cosmology or maybe particle detection. So for example, POVM won't mean anything to you now, but you know, maybe one could think of writing down POVMs for the Large Hadron Collider. So at the moment, all of the particle physics detection is described classically, but these are quantum mechanical particles. And so maybe we need to have a generalized quantum theory of measurement to describe things like particle detection. And so I don't think anyone has like actually done that yet. So maybe in the future, these things will be useful in those areas. Okay, and as I mentioned, the operational framework is really important in modern, yes?
I don't even understand what that means.
What that means? Yeah.
How do you measure particles?
Sorry?
Can you explain that statement?
Can I explain it later when we start talking about generalized measurements? Yeah, so I mean, I think the way that people think about particle detection in these colliders is that you just have some sort of particle and it gets detected and you get a count. But there's a much more sophisticated way to describe measurement, which we will discuss later on in terms of these things called POVMs and generalized measurement and weak measurements. And so this generalized framework of measurement has not been applied to particle detection yet. Like people just calculate scattering matrices or scattering cross sections and they get some probability of like seeing a particle and then they build these detectors and just like count clicks. But you can do things that are more sophisticated and people don't. And I mean, there's a good reason why they don't. It's because they have like way bigger problems right now than like the subtle issues associated with the quantum theory of detection. But at some stage, it'll be like, I think useful to think about it this way. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and so, as I mentioned in quantum foundations, the operational framework is really useful. It's kind of nice because it takes you away from certain interpretational issues. So if you think of the wave function as being actually the corresponding to the physical state of a quantum system, then you get all of these kind of conceptual issues like wave function collapse, which you know is like a super kind of like if you do something here, then it can have an effect on the wave function of this particle on the other side of the universe. So it's an instantaneous, maybe superluminal thing. And if you think about in terms of the operational framework, then you kind of remove yourself from all of these interpretational issues. And also, as I mentioned, some people are applying the operational framework to areas of physics outside of quantum mechanics as well. Yeah, so did I write any of these? What else do I want to say? Oh yeah, useful in many areas of physics. And then operational framework. And it's useful in quantum foundations. Okay. Okay, so now what I wanted to do is kind of sketch out a big concept map that will sort of try to put all of the things that we'll be talking about for most of my section, kind of put it into I don't know, some sort of picture that you can keep in your head as we go along. So as I sketch this thing out, a lot of the things I say maybe won't be very meaningful yet because we won't have covered these concepts. But hopefully by seeing how it all fits together, that'll help you as we're going through the course. And then what I'm going to do is at the end of my section, I will just go through the process again of sketching out the concept map. And at that point, you'll have seen all of the things and hopefully it'll make a lot more sense. But I think it's still useful to see it before we look at all the topics. So as I said, we've split everything up into preparations, transformations, and measurements. Will this fit? So preparations, transformations, and measurements. And what I will do is tomorrow I will start by giving you the ideal version of all of these, of all of the axioms corresponding to these three operational, these three operations. So here we have ideal. Then on Thursday, I'm going to go through the axioms again, but then I will give you the more generalized version of the axioms that corresponds to the realistic scenarios. Okay, so in the ideal case, what we're going to see is that a preparation is described by a pure state. Which we label as psi or ket psi. An ideal transformation is going to be represented by a unitary operator. Which when applied to a preparation gives you another preparation. Maybe I'll start by putting hats on things, but pretty soon I'm going to drop them because most of the things that I write are actually quantum mechanical operators. And then our ideal measurements are going to be described by projectors. So it'll be a set of projectors P with subscript M. And we can do one of two things with those projectors. The first is we can calculate the probability of getting a certain outcome. So we can do that using Born's rule. Or we can say given an outcome M, what is the post-measurement state? And so the post-measurement state will be given by acting that projector on the input state and then dividing by the square root of the probability. Okay, so a lot of this stuff should be relatively familiar to you. You will have seen something similar in undergrad quantum mechanics. The only main conceptual difference here is that we're now thinking of these states as corresponding to preparations rather than the actual physical state, the physical system. Okay, so then for the realistic case, we're going to have preparations are going to be described by density operators. Thank you. So even if you haven't seen these in quantum mechanics, probably you've encountered them in statistical mechanics, where rho can describe a thermal state. The realistic transformations are going to be described by what are called CPTP maps, where CPTP stands for completely positive trace preserving. And I'll go through what that means in the lectures. And so these are typically denoted like that. So it's a map E that acts on the operator rho. And we find that there is something known as the Krauss decomposition, which tells us that if I act the map rho on the map E on rho to get the output state rho prime, I can decompose that into a sum of operators. And so this will become a really useful way of actually implementing and thinking about these CPTP maps. And then our realistic measurements are going to be described by what's known as a POVM, which stands for positive operator valued measure. And so a POVM is a set of operators, EM, which satisfy the condition that they add to the identity. And so we can use these POVM elements to also compute the Born rule. So we can say the probability of getting outcome M is going to be given now by the trace of the density operator rho and this POVM element EM. But if we want to actually compute the state after a particular measurement outcome, we have to take a decomposition of this operator into what are known as measurement operators, and then we can say.
Does the decomposition always exist?
Sorry?
Does the decomposition always exist?
Yes. If this thing satisfies a measurement, then yeah.
Okay.
It always exists, yep. And we'll talk later about how to actually implement these things and how to find them. Okay, and so, the important thing is that it's not unique. Yeah,
yes.
So you can have different POVMs. So when I say POVM, I mean this entire thing. You can have different POVMs that give you the same statistics in terms of the probabilities. But they can be implemented in different ways using different measurement operators. And then different implementations will lead to different post-measurement states, which then will give you different statistics if you make measurements on those things. But given outcome M, rho M is going to be the post-measurement state. And we calculate it like this. Okay, so this seems like a lot so far, but we're going to spend an entire lecture discussing all of this stuff. So that'll be tomorrow's lecture. We're going to spend an entire lecture discussing all of this stuff. Then what we're going to do is make a connection. Yes.
You said that these are trace preserving, but how is it different from being unitary?
Mm-hmm. So we'll discuss this idea of purity later, pure versus mixed states. So pure states are going to be states that can be written like this, while mixed states are going to be states that necessarily have to be written as a density operator. But both of these states will satisfy the condition that they have a trace of one. And so you can have CPTP maps that reduce the purity of a state. So they can take a pure state and make it mixed. But they won't change the fact that the state is trace one, because that's needed in order to, you know, for the probability of measurement outcomes to sum to one. So it's trace preserving, but it's not necessarily purity preserving, if that makes sense. And we'll talk about that a little more as well. So unitary operations are purity preserving, while these things are just trace preserving. Yeah, so we'll spend an entire lecture on this and an entire lecture on that. Then I'm going to kind of make connections between these two things. And this is kind of neat because you might think, well, actually, maybe we can do a vote. Which one of these, you could imagine, you can ask, do I need both sets of axioms, right? Could I just have one set of axioms and could I derive the other one from like given one set, can I derive the other one? And so, yes, you can. And yes, you can derive one from the other. And so the question is, well, which one do I start with in order to derive the other one? So if you think, I don't know how to phrase this question, so this is probably going to be a bad poll. But which set of axioms would you pick as the fundamental one from which you can derive the other set? So that one. So who votes for this one is, yeah. And who votes for that one? No one. Okay, cool. Right. So yes, I mean, you're right. So it's true that you can derive these axioms from this one. And it's kind of obvious how you would do that. So, because these seem more general, right? So you could, So you could imagine I can get from here to there just by saying that my density operator is this pure state like that. I can get from here to here by saying that my unitary operator is just one of these Krauss operators, and I don't have any other Krauss operators. So I can just say. And I can get to here by saying that my projector is just one of these POVM elements. So that's cool. But as we'll see at the end, I don't know if it's, maybe we'll do it by Friday. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the projector would be equivalent to one of the M's rather than the E's.
Well, yes, but a projector is when you multiply a projector by a projector, you get a projector. So you can think about it either way.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, let's do it that way. Now I'm getting confused about which days we're covering things. But okay. In the next lecture, we'll do this. In the lecture after that, we'll do that. In the lecture after that, I'm going to introduce composite systems and have a whole lecture discussion of entanglement. And at that point, once we have this notion of composite systems, we'll see that we can actually derive those axioms from these ones. So we can go in the opposite direction. And so the way that we do that is we now introduce, we write down composite systems that are pure. And by then looking, as long as these systems are entangled, by then looking at just one subsystem of this pure entangled system, we can get a description that then gives us a general density operator. So if we go in this direction, we can say that rho now on system A is going to be made by preparing a pure state on systems A and B, and then tracing out system B. So tracing out a system is a mathematical way of just throwing away a system, saying that you have no access to information about that system. And then in the same way, we'll find that now if I have a composite system and I perform a unitary operation on both of those subsystems in a way that entangles them, then I can describe the transformation on the subsystem as this CPTT map. So our operation, our map on system A is going to be given by preparing system A with some kind of ancillary system B. Then I perform an entangling unitary on both of them. And then I trace out system B. So that gives me an effective CPTP map just on the subsystem A. And then we can do the same thing with measurement, is that if we want to implement some sort of arbitrary POVM, the way to do that is to introduce an ancillary system and then perform a projective measurement on that entire system, which will then give me an effective POVM on my subsystem. So here our measurement operator is going to be given. I just wrote this down from memory, so we'll need to check it later. I might have things the wrong way around, but it'll be something like this. So it'll consist of introducing an ancillary system and then performing a unitary that entangles them and then performing a projective measurement on, actually, I don't know which one we want.
Maybe it's the same. So can you write bigger icon? Cat is.
Yeah, so hang on a sec. Sorry, what are you saying? Can I?
Cat is the zero state, the cat.
Yeah, so this is a cat acting on system B, and this is a bra acting on system B.
Yeah.
This is, we're really gonna go into, you don't have to understand what I'm doing here. We're gonna go into a lot more detail in the other lectures, and I will give you the notes. But yeah, so what I have a projector on B, identity on a unitary that entangles them, and then I kind of sandwich that between a bra and a ket on Hilbert space B, which then gives me an operator on Hilbert space A. Yeah, but we're going to go through and derive all of this from scratch, so don't worry. I'm just trying to kind of give you the big picture here. And so the neat thing here is that neither of these are actually fundamental, because given one set, you can always derive the other set of axioms from it, depending on which way you think about it. And so I think there's kind of something deep about that. And it's a problem for when you teach a course like this, because I know speaking to other lecturers, they, as the years go on, they change their mind about which one is the more fundamental one. And so they start the course either with these ones or with those ones, depending on what their current opinion is on what's more fundamental. I don't know. I don't know if the universe is actually a pure state and evolving unitarily, and then all the non-unitary dynamics is effectively, whether this description is an effective description, or maybe this is the true description and this is just some idealized description that never actually happens. I don't know. Okay, so. so this entire discussion, it's in terms of these kind of weird things like POVM elements and CPTP maps and density operators, and it doesn't seem like there's very much physics going on there. And so even though like I'm trying to motivate this being as a really useful way of thinking about things, sometimes when you're seeing it for the first time, or when you've seen it even many times, it can be easy to get lost in the abstraction. So I think it's really useful to have a few sets of visual tools that you can use to try and get some like pictures in your head of what's going on. And so the three tools that I'm going to make a lot of use of in these lectures are the block sphere, not really circuit diagrams from quantum information, but some kind of hybrid diagrammatic representation that's kind of a cross between this picture up there and a circuit diagram. And also I'll make use of kind of a diagrammatic representation of what would happen in a quantum optics experiment, because sometimes it's just really good to have a physics picture in your head. Rather than just drawing kind of abstract pictures. So for the rest of this lecture, I'm just going to go through, describe these visualization tools and kind of try and give you some intuition for them so that when we see them throughout the course, they're going to be familiar to you. It's a bit disappointing that we don't have the whole board. Okay. All right, so I mean, all of the stuff we're discussing here, it applies to infinite dimensional systems or arbitrary dimensional systems. But it's really useful to just think about two-level systems because we can draw really nice pictures with two-level systems. So often, even when I go through these lectures, I'm going to give you the general description, but then I'll try to give you always an example with a two-level system drawn on the block sphere. Okay, so let's start with two-dimensional systems. So let's consider an arbitrary pure quantum state. Which you can always parametrize as so imagine that our quantum state is some sort of spin half particle. So I can write it as cosine theta on 2 spin up. Plus e to the I phi. Oops. Yeah. Why is no one calling me out on this? Okay, sine theta on 2. And just because it's often easier to draw zeros and ones than up and down arrows, I'm going to use this quantum information notation where I call up to be a zero and down to be a one. Okay, so the neat thing about this state is that it can be parametrized on the surface of a unit sphere. So I can have my sphere like this and then define some axes. So it's common to make the vertical axis be the z-axis, and then we can have the y and the x-axes. And an arbitrary state is going to live somewhere on the surface. statement as follows. So theta is the angle away from the z-axis, and then phi is the angle within the equatorial plane. Okay, so it's useful to label some common states that we typically deal with. So this one here, and this one here are the zero and one states. So these are the basis states in the sigma z basis. And then we also have basis states along the x-axis. So these will be the plus state and the minus state, where plus or minus are equal to superpositions of 0 and 1. And then we also have states that are plus I and minus I. Which are also linear superpositions of 0 and 1, but they have a phase in front of them. So this is kind of just to get your bearings for where the states on the Bloch sphere live. And so hopefully you can check for yourself that if you pick the right theta and phis, then that should give you the correct states on the axes. Okay, so why is this useful? Well, let's make a list. Okay, well, one thing to note, this is not a why this is useful, this is just a warning. So opposite states are orthogonal. So in regular 3D space, you're used to orthogonal vectors being ones that are at 90 degrees. But on the Bloch sphere, states that are orthogonal in the sense that the inner product is zero, those states lie on opposite sides of the sphere. Okay, so there are some things that that will help us develop intuition. So on the Bloch sphere, unitary transformations are just rotations. So if I apply some kind of unitary, I can describe it by an axis on the Bloch sphere as well as an angle. And then I can say, well, this unitary rotates my state like this or like that or whatever. So I already mentioned pure states and mixed states. So pure states live on the surface. While mixed states live inside. And non-unitary Transformations can change the length. So they can change, non-unitary transformations can change the length of the vector. So if I start off with a pure state that lives on the surface and apply some kind of non-unitary transformations, it could get shorter and shorter until it maybe reaches the origin. So these are some things to keep in mind. And then hopefully when I describe something abstract and I give you then an example with the block sphere for a two-level system, that should maybe cement some of those ideas.
Sorry?
Yes.
Do you mean by live inside, given example of the state?
You want me to write down the density matrix, or you want me to draw it on the block sphere?
Yes, something like that, both are okay.
Okay, so maybe if I just, so PG mixed state. So if I just draw a two-dimensional cross-section of the sphere, maybe call this the z-axis and the y-axis, x-axis, then I would have, let's say, the state 0 here, the state plus here, and I could write down a density operator for this state that is, looks like this. Which I can say corresponds to me preparing the pure state 0 half of the time and the pure state plus half of the time. And then it turns out that there's a really nice geometric representation of this in the block sphere, which is that this density operator corresponding to that will lie, will be the geometric average of these two pure states. So the vector corresponding to this state is going to be on the inside of the sphere. And we'll talk more about that later when we discuss mixed states. Yep.
Is there an easy way to calculate probabilities using the block sphere? See the probabilities of measurements?
Yeah, depends. Yeah. So if you just... if you measure in the x, y, or z basis, it's kind of the easiest visually, but the projections onto the x, y, and z axis give you the expectation values of measuring a certain operator. So for example, this here is going to correspond to the expectation value of sigma z. And then you can at least for two-level systems, there's a simple way to decompose those into probabilities, which will be just the probability of getting outcome 0 minus the probability of getting outcome 1. And so given that, you'll be able to work out what these probabilities are. When you've got larger dimensional spaces, given an expectation value, you won't be able to just figure out what the individual probabilities are. But in this case, you can. And you don't have to do measurements in just those three bases. You could imagine doing a measurement that corresponds to projectors, like these two things, and then you would measure along that axis. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so that's the block sphere. The second visualization tool is what I'm going to call the circuit diagram. But I'm using circuit kind of loosely because it's not really the formal way that they draw circuits in quantum information, but it's kind of a circuit-like representation of the operations that I described up there. So again, the circuit diagram will consist of preparations, transformations, and measurements. And it'll just be a bunch of boxes. So I would have the first box. I can write down my state. Another box that has a unitary. And then a final box that has the measurement described by, for example, a set of projectors. And then out of the measurement box, I can have an output state, because sometimes we can measure something and use that as a way to prepare a state, but we can also have some sort of classical output, which is the information about the measurement outcome. So I can say this is the quantum output, and this is the classical output. And it's just common in quantum information circuits to represent classical information by double lines and quantum information by single lines. And so, well, you might think, well, this is just, you know, like the same thing as those boxes that I was drawing there. But with those boxes, there was kind of an implicit space. So I was, you know, saying that there's one box on the left, a box in the middle, and a box on the right. While here, these don't necessarily have to be spatially separated operations. It's not like there's a particle moving between this box to the other box. It's just a flow of information. So for example, this could be describing just having a single two-level atom that's maybe in some sort of trap. And then we're applying operations to this system by maybe shining laser pulses at it or something. So it's not like this thing is traveling from here to here. It's just describing a series of operations that are being applied to the quantum system. And so you can think about this dimension as being time rather than position. So why is this useful? Well, I can give you a few examples, which we then will see later throughout the course. So it gives a nice visual way to think about combining different operations. So for example, I could be, let's say, working with a physical system in which it's really natural to measure in one particular basis, maybe the ground and excited basis of the atom, but I actually want to perform a measurement in a different basis. Well, we can see from the diagram that it's really easy to construct a measurement in a different basis if I just, let's say, relabel this whole thing as now being a measurement in some different basis P prime. So now I have state psi being measured in this basis. So I can just combine this box and that box and turn it into a different box. And so mathematically, that would be, I would say that P M prime is equal to the inverse of that unitary acting on this projector. So now I have a new measurement basis. So yeah, you can do it mathematically, but when things get more complicated, when you're trying to combine lots of different things together, it's just nice to be able to draw out this circuit and you can really see how to combine different things together. Alternatively, I can think about this being a preparation of a different state. Maybe I have some type of physical system that naturally prepares states in a particular basis, but I want to prepare states in a different basis. Well, I can just think of this whole thing as being a preparation of some different state and then measured in the original basis. Where now psi prime is the unitary acting on the psi. So again, this is kind of trivial, but when things get more complicated, it's just useful drawing these boxes and seeing how they combine. And the final example where this will become visually useful is when we start talking about composite systems and thinking about how tracing out one particular subsystem gives you an effective description on another subsystem. So for example, if I have, if I want to perform some kind of operation on the state UA, I can introduce some sort of ancillary system B. I can perform a unitary operation on both of these guys, which will in general give me now some sort of entangled state, but I can just take this entire thing and now rewrite that as an effective map on the system A. Which looks like this. So hopefully, I'm kind of convincing you that just drawing these pictures gives you a nice visual representation of all of the things that we're going to see mathematically, because it'll give you something to kind of keep in mind. Okay, and then, yeah, the final thing. I find these really useful, but sometimes you just want to like get a physical, imagine some kind of physical system. I know most people really like to imagine Stern-Gerlach experiments with two-level spin-up and spin-down systems. They're really hard to draw, on the board. And just, I don't know, I guess because my background is in quantum optics, I'm just much more comfortable thinking about photons. So I will tend to just draw circuits with photons. But if you're much more comfortable with Stern-Gerlach or some other system, by all means, like use that for your own, like to develop your own physical intuition. And you know, maybe you can think about mapping what I'm doing to the system that you like. But my go-to is always going to be a quantum optics system. And so the most basic quantum optics system is a single photon, which has information encoded in the polarization degrees of freedom. So I can take the horizontal and the vertical polarizations of the photon as being the basis. And actually, this description maps really nicely to the Bloch sphere, except in optics, it's then called the Poincaré sphere. And there you find that you have things get a bit messy, but because the Poincaré sphere is actually rotated from the Bloch sphere. But on the Poincaré sphere, you would have right and left circularly polarized light on the z-axis, and then you would have horizontal and vertical light on the x-axis, and then diagonal, anti-diagonal light on the other axes. But so there's kind of a natural physical way of thinking about all those basis states. So let me just say in optics, so the basis is going to be horizontal or vertical polarization of a photon. So, I'm going to imagine that the photon is created by this mythical device called a photon gun. Maybe you can think of it as being some kind of two-level atom that spits out, like when it decays, it spits out a photon. There are other ways of making them, but some kind of device that creates a single photon, which then propagates. And then I can do unitary, I can apply unitary operations to that photon using what are called wave plates. So wave plates are pieces of birefringent material which have a particular width. And they also have an optical axis that you can use, well, that changes the wave plate depending on how it's oriented. And so what a wave plate typically does is it delays one polarization with respect to the other, which effectively on the Bloch sphere just causes a rotation on the Bloch sphere. And so wave plates are usually parametrized by two angles. Phi and theta. And so let me just make sure I get this right. So if you want to implement a particular operation on the Bloch sphere, then the optical, so physically rotating your wave plate changes the optical axis, which then changes the axis about which you're going to be rotating in the Bloch sphere. And then the width of the wave plate determines how much you rotate. So if you have, so typical wave plates are things like half wave plates and quarter wave plates. Which rotate, I guess, by pi. Yeah, so these are optical elements that rotate you by pi or pi on 2 on the Bloch sphere. So they're nice, they can do like flips. And then you choose the axis of rotation by rotating, physically rotating this thing. And so, you know, people work really hard to try and get these thicknesses to be just right to get the desired angle. But if you just pick some like random piece of birefringent material, for example, like if you have a smartphone and then on your smartphone you have like this piece of plastic that protects the screen, that's a wave plate. It's a birefringent material, and it'll, if you send a polarized photon through this wave plate, it's going to perform a unitary operation, but maybe it'll rotate the angle by like pi on 32 or something, not pi on 2. Okay, so anyway, that's like an extended discussion of wave plates, but essentially just think of it as like some sort of piece of plastic or glass that can perform unitary operations. And then to make measurements, we typically do those in the horizontal vertical basis. And the way we do that is we send the light through a polarizing beam splitter, which is another piece of another optical element, which then splits it into horizontal and vertical. And then we just put detectors that click. So they register that they've seen a photon. So this detector, it can't tell whether it's horizontal or vertical, but because it's been now split into this path being vertical and this path being horizontal, it can now measure in this basis. So if you have your two-level system and you prepare some kind of state and you didn't have these wave plates, then what you would be doing here is performing a measurement in the HV basis. But now if you wanted to change the basis of your measurement, you would put in some wave plates and pick some settings for those wave plates to get whatever basis you're interested in. So that's one way that you could physically implement all of these measurements and operations that we'll be discussing on the Bloch sphere. But if you like, you can think about how you would do these things in a different system, maybe a two-level atom or a spin half particle, and that might be something that's useful for you to think about. So we have just a couple of minutes. So what I will just do is give you a list of all of the things that we will do in the rest of the course. So on Wednesday, which is tomorrow, we're going to do the ideal postulates and something called quantum state tomography. Which is a procedure that answers the question, you know, how do I know that the preparation device that I have actually is giving me the density operator rho that I write down. So by performing quantum state tomography, we can characterize a preparation device. On Thursday, we will look at the realistic postulates. On Friday, we will look at composite systems. And entanglement. Then we'll have a weekend. And then on Monday, we'll discuss purifications and dilations. Purifications. So what this will consist of is going through the realistic postulates again, but in a slightly different way. So here on Thursday, I will mainly discuss this in terms of probabilistic implementations of the ideal postulates, while here when we discuss purifications and dilations, we'll see how the realistic postulates arise as effective descriptions of ideal operations on larger dimensional Hilbert spaces. But for that, we need to first discuss composite systems. Then on Tuesday, we'll put it all together. So we'll have learned all of these different concepts. But it'll be nice to see how they can actually be used to solve a research problem. So I'll spend the whole lecture going through a paper that describes a procedure for applying quantum control of a single qubit. And this will be nice because it'll actually show you how, you know, how all of these things are useful or used in practice. Then on Wednesday, I'll review the concept map. So we'll go through everything again, and at that point, you'll know more about all these things we talked about, and it'll also give you an opportunity. Maybe it'll spark some questions you had that you forgot, so you'll be able to ask them at that point. And then I'll do some fun topics in quantum information. So one thing I'd like to do is to describe the quantum teleportation protocol to you. And also talk about something called the no cloning theorem. And if there are other things that maybe you're interested in, you can tell me in advance and I can think about whether I can prepare something on that. But this will kind of just be a fun things. We won't cover this stuff in the interviews or anything. It'll just be, yeah, hopefully interesting. Okay, so that's it for the first lecture. And yeah, tomorrow we'll start with the ideal postulates. And do you guys have any questions? If not, I'll see you tomorrow.